Y'all, it's Jey Uso from WWE.
And I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer, SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting
than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience
with Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino and enter for your chance to win. Let's Chumba.
Yeah. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams 4th of July sale and get 30% off paints and stains June 26th through July 6th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only, some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T&Cs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Sometimes the only way to describe the deplorable actions of a human being is by using the word evil. Actions so twisted, so dark and disturbing, the human mind can barely comprehend them actually taking place. Today we hear about these actions through the story of terror rained down on the city of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, at the hands of Jeffrey Dahmer.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Jeffrey Lionel Dahmer, also known as the Milwaukee Cannibal, or Milwaukee Monster, was an American serial killer and sex offender who committed and murdered and dismembered 17 men and boys from 1978 to 1991. Many of his later murders involved necrophilia, cannibalism, and the permanent preservation of body parts, typically all or part of the skeleton. Although he was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, schizophrenia, personality disorder, and psychotic disorder, Dahmer was found to be legally sane at his trial. He was convicted of 15 of the 16 murders he had committed in Wisconsin and was sentenced to 15 terms of life imprisonment. On February 15, 1992, he was later sentenced to a 16th term of life imprisonment for an additional homicide committed in Ohio in 1978. On November 28, 1994, Dahmer was beaten to death by Christopher Scavier, a fellow inmate at the Columbia Correctional Institution. So that's the monster we are talking about today on the Dark Side of Wikipedia. This is probably going to be a two-part episode because there's just so much information on this case. We're going to break it up, but it is something that, having myself grown up in Wisconsin, I remember vividly. I was a child at the time. I was about 10, 11 when the trial was going on and the horrors of this story were coming out. Our co-host on today's episode, Sean, is joining us. And if you listen to our other podcasts, you know him from there. He grew up in the city of Milwaukee when a lot of this stuff was going on. So it's going to be some kind of personal perspectives, albeit from our childhood minds, of what we understood at that moment in time. But we're going to go through the whole story of Jeffrey Dahmer on the dark side of Wikipedia. So welcome, Sean, to this happy, uplifting episode of the program, as it always is.
Glad to be a part of this Pony and Rainbow podcast, Tony. Boy, this new show, man, really gets you going here on a Wednesday.
I should note, as we are recording this episode, just so we
have... I'm in a bunker.
We'll put our historical timestamp on it. It is what is it, Jenner? March 18th of 2020. And if you look in your encyclopedia or Wikipedia of the coronavirus, you will see where we are at this point in time, and we have no idea what the future is about to hold, or what, you know, any of it. We're kind of in the beginning stages in the United States. Things are shutting down. Things are getting locked down. People are not at work. It's craziness. So what are we going to do? We're going to distract ourselves with the story of a serial killer. And if you're tuning in while that shit show is going on, welcome. And I hope you enjoy the brief distraction as best as you can. What's your memory? And we can go into much greater detail about how you felt when all this stuff was going on back in the 90s. But what was your memory of life like the 30-second version of it in Milwaukee as all this stuff was happening?
I remember as it was happening, I mean, on the news during the trial, when you're 9, when you're 10 years old, when you watch the news, it's a lot different than watching the news as an adult for the actual news. I was just waiting for sports, and it didn't really horrify me, probably because my mom, dad was nice enough to cover my ears or not allow me to really ever understand what he truly did. But yeah. The one thing that really stood out is he worked for a chocolate factory, Ambrosia Chocolates in Milwaukee. And growing up, the one thing I can remember above all else is I just wanted to go past the plant, the factory, to see where he worked.
Yeah. And I think that was the fear that a lot of people had. There was a fear that... public hysteria that went into it was, you know, did he put something in the chocolates? It's like, I don't believe he did. Did he? I mean, I'm sure we'll find out in the story, but it was more so just he worked there, right?
He worked there, and the stereotypical, well, he didn't seem any different than Carl over there on the assembly line. Only, you know, Carl didn't have three hearts in his freezer, which is delicious around Easter time, I'm told. But
chocolate.
Correct. Chocolate hearts. I don't really ever think that there was a conspiracy theory where he got rid of some of the body parts at work. That never really, from what I remember in local coverage, that didn't come up.
No. Maybe it was where I grew up because they like try to find conspiracy and everything. I do remember some aspects of that where people were like, you know, it's a morbid connection. And why would you make that connection other than just to kind of freak each other out? But there was never any evidence or anything that even pointed to that. But I think it's just, well, you know, it's a kind of a somewhat public facing thing that was, you know, there's a chocolate factory and they have a serial killer that works there. So he must be putting fingers in the chocolate. Like, what the fuck are you?
I mean, how can you cover up 17 bodies in a 600-square-foot apartment?
We are about to find that out as we dig into the story of Jeffrey Dahmer here on the dark side of Wikipedia. Let's continue on. Jeffrey Lionel Dahmer was born at the Evangelical Deaconess Hospital in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, on May 21st, 1960. The first of two sons born to Joyce Annette and Lionel Herbert Dahmer. Dahmer's mother worked as a teletype machine instructor, and his father was a student at Marquette University, working towards a degree in chemistry. His father was of German and Welsh ancestry, and his mother was of Norwegian and Irish ancestry. It has been claimed that Dahmer was deprived of attention as an infant. Other sources, however, suggest that generally Dahmer was a doted upon child as an infant and toddler by both parents. Although his mother was known to be tense, greedy for both attention and pity, and argumentative with her husband and their neighbors. As her son entered first grade, Joyce Dahmer began to spend an increasing amount of her time in bed recovering from weakness. Lionel's university studies kept him away from home much of the time while he was home. His wife demanded constant attention. She reportedly worked herself into a state of anxiety over trivial matters simply to appease her husband. On one occasion, Joyce Dahmer attempted suicide from an overdose of pills to which she had become addicted. Consequently, neither parent devoted much time to their son. Dahmer had been described as being an energetic and happy child until he became notably subdued after undergoing a double hernia surgery, which was performed shortly before his fourth birthday. He recalled his early years of family life as being of extreme tension, which he noted between his parents, whom he observed to be constantly arguing with each other. At elementary school, he was regarded as both quiet and timid by his peers. On his first grade report card, one teacher described Dahmer as a reserved child whom she sensed felt neglected. This teacher did note that this sense of neglect seemed to stem from his mother's illness. Nonetheless, although largely reserved and uncommunicative in grade school, Dahmer did have a small number of friends. From an early age, Dahmer manifested an interest in dead animals. Friends later recalled Dahmer's initially collecting large insects, such as dragonflies and butterflies, which he placed inside jars. Later, he collected animal carcasses from the roadside, occasionally accompanied by one or more of his few friends. He dismembered these animals either at home or in an expanse of woodland behind the family home. According to one friend, Dahmer dismembered these animals and stored the parts in jars in the family's wooden tool shed, always explaining that he was curious how each animal fitted together. In one instance, he decapitated the carcass of a dog before nailing the animal's body to a tree. He later impaled the skull of the dog upon a stake beside a wooden cross in the woodlands behind his house. Dahmer's fascination with dead animals might have begun when, at the age of 4, he noted his father removing animal bones from beneath the family home. According to Lionel Dahmer, his son was oddly thrilled by the sound the bones made and instantly developed a fixation for playing with and collecting animal bones. He occasionally searched beneath and around the family home for additional bones. With live animals, he explored their bodies to discover where their bones were located. The Dahmer family relocated to Doylestown, Ohio in October of 1966. At the time, Joyce Dahmer was pregnant with her second child. When she gave birth to a baby boy on December 18, 1966, Jeffrey was allowed to choose the name of the baby. He chose the name David for his younger brother. The same year, Lionel Dahmer achieved his degree and subsequently obtained employment as an analytical chemist in the city of Akron, Ohio. In 1968, the family relocated to Bath, Ohio. 2 years later, over a family meal of chicken, Dahmer asked his father what would happen if the bones of the chicken were to be placed in a bleach solution. Lionel Dahmer was by this stage concerned as to his elder son's placid and lethargic attitude and his solitary existence. Therefore, he was delighted at the initiative displayed by his son towards what he believed to be scientific curiosity. He willingly demonstrated to his son how to safely bleach and later preserve animal bones. Dahmer used this knowledge regarding the cleansing and preserving of bones on many of the animal remains, which he continued to avidly collect. From his freshman year at Revere High School, Dahmer was seen by his peers as an outcast, with very few friends. Many of Dahmer's classmates later recollected being disturbed by the fact that he drank both beer and hard alcohol, which he smuggled into school inside the lining of his army fatigue jacket and concealed in his locker. The drinking occurred before, during, and after school, and was first noted when Dahmer was 14. On one occasion, a classmate observed Dahmer consuming a cup of gin and asked him why he was drinking liquor in class, to which Dahmer casually replied, "It's my medicine." In his freshman year at Revere High School, Dahmer, although largely uncommunicative, was observed by staff to be a polite student who was known to be highly intelligent. He initially achieved only average grades, which staff attributed to his apathy. He was also known to have been a keen tennis player and have briefly played in the high school band. Dahmer, at age 17, photographed for the 1977 Revere High School yearbook. When he reached puberty, Dahmer discovered he was gay. He did not divulge his sexual orientation to his parents. In his early teens, he did engage in a brief relationship with another youth, although the pair never had intercourse. By his later admission, he began sexually fantasizing about dominating and controlling a completely submissive male partner. These fantasies gradually became intertwined with dissection. On one occasion, when he was approximately 16 years old, Dahmer conceived of a rape fantasy of rendering unconscious a particular male jogger he found attractive and then making sexual use of his unconscious body. To render the man unconscious, Dahmer concealed himself in bushes on the route he had noted the jogger took, baseball bat in hand, and lie in wait for him to run by. The jogger did not pass by on that particular day, however. Although Dahmer never attempted to implement this plan again, he later stated that it was his first attempt to attack another individual. Despite being regarded as a loner and an oddball among his peers at Revere High School, Dahmer became something of a class clown among some students due to the pranks he regularly staged, some of which were done to amuse his classmates, other apparently to simply attract attention. These pranks became known as doing a Dahmer and included bleeding, simulating epileptic seizures or cerebral palsy, and knocking over items at school and at local stores. By 1977, Dahmer's grades had declined, owing to his alcohol abuse and his continuing apathy towards academic and social interactions. His parents hired a private tutor for their son, but the tutor only had limited success. The same year, Dahmer's parents attended counseling sessions to try to resolve personal differences and thus save their marriage. The counseling was ultimately unsuccessful, and they decided to divorce. Although initially only on amicable grounds, both of Dahmer's parents began to quarrel frequently in the presence of their sons. And in early 1978, Lionel Dahmer moved out of the house. In May 1978, Dahmer graduated from high school. A few weeks before his graduation, one of his teachers observed Dahmer sitting close to the school parking lot, drinking several cans of beer. When the teacher threatened to report the matter, Dahmer informed him he was experiencing a lot of problems at home and that the school's guidance counselor was aware. Shortly after the incident, Joyce was awarded custody of her younger son and vacated the family residence, moving in with family members of hers. Dahmer, having just turned 18, was legally an adult and therefore not subject to court custodial considerations. So a very different upbringing, I guess one could say, I guess depending on where one comes from, but certainly a lot of chaos.
That's kind of weird that they let him name his younger brother.
Is that a thing? I don't know. I have no siblings, so I don't know.
I didn't know that was a thing. I mean, I'm the youngest, so I wasn't in on any naming of children because it was me and that was it. But sure. I don't remember my sisters having anything to do with naming me.
Do you attribute any of that to anything, or just are making an observation of like, well, that's odd?
I think just making an observation that from a very early age, he was involved in just a very odd, air quotes, upbringing. And I think you toss that in with, I mean, anyone growing up and I really don't think there's any perfect childhood. We all go through our ups and downs. And if you're already in a situation from a very early age of an odd situation, to have so much enjoyment in bone crushings and the sound, that's, I mean, I appreciate Mr. Dahmer, his dad. Hey, you like this? Let me teach you more.
Yeah.
But that's got to be interesting. Like, hey, let's go play. I tell you what, we're only an hour and a half away from Lambeau Field. Let's go to a football game.
Yeah.
Oh, you want to learn more how to put bones on? Okay, yeah, that's good. No.
Yeah. Yeah, or at the time, the Packers were playing in Milwaukee, too, every other game.
And we don't even need to go to Green Bay. Absolutely.
It's right there, County Stadium. But you're right. It's one of those things where it sounds like the dad, you know, obviously no one is going to, I guess, naturally assume that your child has serial killer tendencies. I guess maybe now there's a lot more to look out for. But at the time, there wasn't Dateline, there wasn't any of this shit where everybody can kind of be an amateur psychologist. Whereas today, a lot of us probably have a lot more knowledge on some of these things, for good and bad, where sometimes we can overanalyze people and go, holy shit, that's going to be another Jeffrey Dahmer. And it's not. They just have an interest in, you know, things in the outdoors and hunting or something like that. It's when it takes it to the level of what Dahmer did. And the identification and what he was doing with the animal carcasses and remains, that things started to look really disturbing. I remember as a kid, and this, I never hurt animals. I love my cat. I never had a dog. I had hamsters that I liked but did not like me. They'd always bite me. But as a kid, I liked killing ants in the yard. That was my thing. We'd have ant hills out there, and I kind of made it my mission to try and eradicate the yard of ant hills because my parents didn't use any sort of lawn professionals or sprays or anything that would actually do that. So I would go out there and I would be like pouring tons of water on the ant hills and things of that nature. I had no siblings. There was no kids in the neighborhood. So this is how I spent my summers entertaining myself, at war with the ant hills.
You waterboarded ants.
I guess into a certain way I did. But I was, you know, like 7 or 8, and this is what I found amusing. And I look back and go, that wasn't that crazy for a 7 or 8 year old little boy to be out playing and messing with anthills. But the thing is that my point on that is my mother throughout childhood, I was doing that shit when the Dahmer trial was going on. That was about the age I was. And my mother, because sometimes she doesn't know what is appropriate to say or not appropriate to say to me as a child, would be going, oh my gosh, you're doing the same stuff Jeffrey Dahmer did.
No, she didn't.
Yes, she did. And I didn't know what the hell Jeffrey Dahmer did. I just knew Jeffrey Dahmer was in the news and did a lot of bad shit. And I remember her saying things like that to me, like comparing me, because I liked to go play with the anthills. And she was like genuinely concerned for a moment or two that, like, oh, is there something wrong with him? And I'm like, what the fuck? I think it made me want to go play with the anthills even more, because just like, fuck you. I'm not fucking, what? Like, no, they're anthills. Like, I'm not hurting.
Well, to her credit,
yeah.
To her credit, firstborn, and you don't, I mean, you've got a manual. How to be a mother.
Yeah, and only, and there was no other kids to distract. I was the only distraction, so. Yeah.
So, and it's leading to have the best for you, but yeah, when he was oddly thrilled by the sound the bones made.
That's fucked up.
What do you do as a dad? I mean, you don't want to poo-poo anything that your children are taking a liking to. But I don't know. I mean, the world of biology, I would imagine current day scientists. And I mean, what was Jack Hanna doing when he was 7? I would imagine he had a fascination with animals as well.
Yeah.
But maybe not killing them. Or he didn't kill them. He just roadkill.
Yeah.
Right?
I believe so. I believe it was...
Animals were already dead.
Yeah, I was finding dead animals and looking at... And one could look at it one way. It's like, oh, this person's interested in biology and science and that sort of angle. But obviously his actions, now that we know what they were, now that he said it to everybody, were obviously a lot darker than that. But yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where as a parent, what the fuck do you do when they're a kid? You know, once they're an adult and they're acting kind of crazy, you can distance. But when they're a kid, got to try and steer them, but sometimes you can only do so much steering before the wheel breaks off and it's like, what the fuck? So
what I find interesting is, where was his brother in this scenario?
I'm interested.
They're not that far apart in age.
I'm interested to learn more of that too, because I don't remember much of his brother's story when any of this was going on. I remember his father doing an interview with Jeffrey Dahmer on, I don't know if it was Dateline or something back in the day. And it was a very fascinating interview. But I don't know, maybe we'll find out more of that as we get into more of this just completely twisted story of Jeffrey Dahmer. Let's continue on. Dahmer committed his first murder in the summer of 1978 at the age of 18, just 3 weeks after his graduation. At the time, he was living alone in the family home, owing to his recent divorce from Dahmer's mother. Dahmer's father temporarily lived in a nearby motel. His mother had relocated to Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. With his younger brother David, on June 18th, Dahmer picked up a hitchhiker named Stephen Mark Hicks, who was only 4 days shy of his 19th birthday. Dahmer lured the youth to his house on the pretext of the two young men drinking alcohol together. Hicks, who had been hitchhiking to a rock concert in Lockwood Corners, agreed to accompany Dahmer to his house. According to Dahmer, after several hours of drinking and listening to music, Hicks wanted to leave and he didn't want him to. In response, Dahmer bludgeoned him with a 10-pound dumbbell. Dahmer later stated he struck Hicks twice from behind with a dumbbell as Hicks sat upon a chair. When Hicks fell unconscious, Dahmer strangled him to death with the bar of the dumbbell, then stripped his clothes from Hicks' body before masturbating as he stood above the corpse. The following day, Dahmer dissected Hicks' body in his basement. He later buried the remains in a shallow grave in his backyard, before several weeks later unearthing the remains and paring the flesh from his bones. He dissolved the flesh in acid before flushing the solution down the toilet. He crushed the bones with a sledgehammer and scattered them in the woodland before the family home. 6 weeks after the murder of Hicks, Dahmer's father and his fiance returned to his home, where they discovered Jeffrey living alone in the house. That August, Dahmer enrolled at Ohio State University, hoping to major in business. Dahmer's sole term at Ohio State University was completely unproductive, largely because of his persistent alcohol abuse throughout the majority of the term. He received failing grades in Introduction to Anthropology, Classical Civilizations, and Administrative Science. The only course Dahmer was successful at was Riflery, having received a B-minus grade. His overall GPA was 0.45. On one occasion, Lionel Dahmer paid a surprise visit to his son, only to find his room strewn with empty liquor bottles. Despite his father having paid in advance for the second term, Dahmer dropped out of the university after just 3 months. In January 1979, on his father's urging, Dahmer enlisted in the U.S. Army, where he trained as a medical specialist at Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio. On July 13, 1979, he was stationed at Bromholder, West Germany, where he served as a combat medic in the 2nd Battalion, 68th Armored Regiment, 8th Infantry Division. According to published reports, in Dahmer's first year of service, he was an average or slightly above average soldier. Two soldiers attested to having been raped by Dahmer while in the Army. One stated in 2010 that Dahmer had repeatedly raped him over a 17-month period while they were both stationed at Bromholder, while another soldier believes Dahmer drugged and raped him inside an armored personnel carrier in 1979. Owing to Dahmer's alcohol abuse, his performance deteriorated, and in March 1981, he was deemed unsuitable for military service and was later discharged from the Army. He received an honorable discharge, and his superiors did not believe that any problems Dahmer had in the Army would be applicable to civilian life. On March 24, 1981, Dahmer was sent to Fort Jackson, South Carolina, for debriefing and provided with a plane ticket to travel anywhere in the country. Dahmer later told police he felt he could not return home to face his father, so he opted to travel to Miami Beach, Florida, both because he was tired of the cold and in an attempt to live by his own means. In Florida, Dahmer found employment as a delicatessen and rented a home and a room in a nearby motel. Dahmer spent most of his salary on alcohol and was soon evicted from the motel for non-payment. He initially spent his evenings on the beach as he continued to work at the sandwich shop until phoning his father and asking to return to Ohio in September of the same year. After his return to Ohio, Dahmer initially resided with his father and stepmother and insisted on being delegated numerous chores to occupy his time while he looked for work. He continued to drink heavily, and 2 weeks after his return, Dahmer was arrested for drunk and disorderly conduct, for which he was fined $60 and given a suspended 10-day jail sentence. Dahmer's father tried unsuccessfully to wean his son off alcohol. In December 1981, Dahmer's father and stepmother sent him to live with his grandmother in West Allis, Wisconsin. Dahmer's grandmother was the only family member to whom he displayed any affection. They hoped that her influence plus the change of scenery might inspire Dahmer to refrain from alcohol, find a job, and live responsibly. Initially, Dahmer's living arrangements with his grandmother were harmonious. She accompanied him to church, willingly undertook chores, and actively sought work, and abided by most of her house rules, although he did continue to drink and smoke. This new influence in his life initially brought results, and in early 1982, Dahmer found employment as a phlebotomist at the Milwaukee Blood Plasma Center. He held this job for a total of 10 months before being laid off. He remained unemployed for over 2 years, during which he lived upon whatever money his grandmother gave him. Shortly before losing his job, Dahmer was arrested for indecent exposure. On August 7, 1982, at Wisconsin State Fair Park, Dahmer was observed to expose himself to a crowd of 25 women and children. For this incident, he was convicted and fined $50 plus court costs. In January of 1985, Dahmer was hired as a mixer at the Milwaukee Ambrosia Chocolate Factory, where he worked from 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. 6 nights per week, with Saturday evenings off. Shortly after Dahmer found this employment, an incident occurred in which he was propositioned by another man while sitting reading in West Allis Public Library. The stranger threw Dahmer a note offering to perform fellatio upon him. Although Dahmer did not respond to the proposition, the incident stirred his mind and the fantasies of control and dominance he had developed as a teenager, and he began to familiarize himself with Milwaukee's gay bars, bookstores, and gay bathhouses. He's also known to have stolen a male mannequin from a store, which he briefly used for sexual stimulation until his grandmother discovered the item stowed in a closet and demanded that he discard it. By late 1985, he had begun to regularly frequent the bathhouses, which he later described as being relaxing places. But during his sexual encounters, he became frustrated at his parents moving during the sexual act. Following his arrest, he stated, "I trained myself to view people as objects of pleasure instead of as people." For this reason, beginning in June of 1986, he administered sleeping pills to his partners, giving them liquor laced with the sedatives and raping them as their unconscious bodies lie there. After approximately 12 such instances, the bathhouse's administration revoked Dahmer's membership, and he began to use hotel rooms to continue this practice. Shortly after his membership of the bathhouses was revoked, Dahmer read a report in the newspaper regarding the upcoming funeral of an 18-year-old male. He conceived the idea of stealing the freshly interred corpse and taking it home. According to Dahmer, he attempted to dig the coffin from the ground, but found the soil too hard before abandoning the plan. In August of 1986, Dahmer was arrested for masturbating in front of two 12-year-old boys as he stood close to the river. Dahmer initially admitted the offense and was again charged with indecent exposure, but quickly changed his story and claimed he had merely been urinating, unaware that there were witnesses. The charge was changed to disorderly conduct, and on March 10, 1987, Dahmer was sentenced to 1 year of probation. With additional instructions, he was to undergo counseling. So a lot to unpack there of that chapter of his story. I guess my first question, and I don't know if you know the answer to this, but what exactly is a bathhouse?
That's a really interesting question. Coincidentally, in living in Little Rock, Arkansas, just down the road from Hot Springs, Arkansas, which is the home of the, they have a bathhouse row.
Okay.
Which I myself was a bit confused as to what a bathhouse is. Apparently, back in the day, you could, I thought it was, you know, taking a bath.
Yeah.
But there were women who, it's almost like a current day spa, salon.
Okay.
And I never really fully understood what it was.
I'm looking at the Wikipedia entry for it. And it says a commercial space. This is the modern interpretation of it. A commercial space for men to have sex with other men. This is just straight out of Wikipedia. In gay slang, a bathhouse may be just called the baths, the sauna, the tubs. In general, it's used for having sexual activity rather than only bathing. So there's the answer.
So it's basically a locker room, but rather than, you know, like just using the amenities, you take part in other amenities.
Yeah, I guess I did not know that was a thing that existed like that. Does that still exist today? I'm assuming I don't know. It seems like that wouldn't, or I don't know. I've just never heard of that. I mean, I've heard of, like, you know, you go to the kind of shady massage parlor type thing and that happens, but I guess I didn't know that this was a thing, but I don't know.
You can get your nails done in the front and there are women and then,
sure.
And then in the back, other things. I didn't know that Milwaukee had these bathrooms.
Yeah,
I know.
You never got like a gift certificate for your birthday?
It's funny. I was just trying to check to see, because I can't go there clearly right now in this time that we're recording this. Coronavirus. But I believe they are still, I don't believe they're operating in the way that they were back then. But for example, like Bathhouse Row, one of the old bathhouses has been converted into a brewery and the physical structures are there, but they talk of Bathhouse Row as something that was revered. So I don't know if the modern day interpretation is different than what it was. I'd like to think that if it was the same thing, that you wouldn't be talking of this great rich history of Bathhouse Row. I'd sweep that under the rug.
I don't know. I don't know what, interesting, that being, something where he was plotting to take advantage of people the way that he did. Any other area of that huge chapter that you want to unpack or talk about that stood out to you? That was,
well,
there's a couple.
We found out if his brother. Yeah, we found out about his brother.
Yep.
Was basically, I don't know if he was physically in the same room when he committed his first murder. It doesn't really talk about whether he was driving the getaway vehicle.
What I wonder about is how the hell do you go on in any sort of, you know, capacity with your grandson, where it wouldn't be incredibly awkward after you find his sex mannequin in the closet.
That's an interesting Thanksgiving Day dinner at the table.
It's not like you just like found, you know, a vibrator or something like that. Like, okay, people own those things, you know, or a magazine or something. It's like, oh, oops, didn't mean to do that. That's just an awkward moment, and you respect going, well, people are people. It's something a little different when you have the mannequin he stole from Prangy Way sitting there in the closet. It's like, holy shit, that's a Prangy Way mannequin. What the hell?
I recognize seeing this mannequin just past domestics at JCPenney on Saturday, and now it is in Jeffrey's closet?
What the hell? Why is there a hole there? Yeah. I don't think that naturally comes on the mannequin. I think there probably had to be some sort of, some work done, probably to make it functional. I guess, for what he was doing, is my guess. I don't know.
I mean, what you have to imagine that there was a phone call to Jeffrey's mom and dad from the grandmother. I mean, how would that conversation go? Ring, ring, ring.
Hello?
Oh, hello, Lionel. How are you? It's your mother.
Oh, I'm Lionel. I'm doing great, Ma. I was gonna be the old lady, but okay, yeah, I'm doing great, Ma.
Oh no, okay. I'll be Lionel.
Okay, Mom, I can do old lady better, and I don't know if that's good or bad. Okay, so
hi, Mom.
Hi, dear. I wanted to talk to you about something. You know, Jeffrey's been here in the house, and we've been having some great canasta games and mahjong.
He doesn't really care about us, but he seems to really love you, Mom.
So, and he loves...
You know, him living there is good.
And I want to say this, too, because I don't know what to think about it. After we had finished a nice warm plate of spaghetti the other night, I went to his room, and I found a mannequin from Prangies that he was jamming his penis into. What do you think of
what?
That? Was that something he used to do back home?
Yeah. It was probably an awkward moment. I mean, how do you move on from that? How do you not go, get the fuck out of my house? I don't know. I mean, it's like, this is a little much. I don't know. I guess the line in the sand is different.
Grandparents, parents, I mean, a mother's love, it has no bounds. And a grandmother, you know, here's the thing. Growing up, if you would do something wrong, you know, your grandparents, they wouldn't tell your parents.
Yeah.
Be like, oh, he wasn't supposed to use his allowance on buying candy. He was supposed to keep it to baseball cards and stuff that will not rot your teeth.
Yeah.
In this case, hey, my little grandson is using a mannequin to enjoy himself.
Yeah.
I wish he bought candy to rot his teeth.
It would be an odd moment. It would certainly be an odd moment. Yeah.
And then he goes to the army after already committing a murder.
Yeah, well, no one knew about the murder yet. And all that came out after the fact.
Did his brother?
I don't know what the brother's involvement really was. So, I don't know. Let's do another chapter here on this one. On November 20th, 1987, Dahmer, at the time residing with his grandmother in West Allis, Wisconsin, encountered a 25-year-old man from Michigan named Stephen Tomey. At the bar, he persuaded him to return to the Ambassador Hotel in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where Dahmer had rented a room for the evening. According to Dahmer, he had no intention of murdering Tomey, but rather intended to drug and rape him as he lay unconscious. The following morning, however, he awoke to find Tomey laying beneath him on the bed, his chest crushed in and black and blue, with bruises. Blood was also seeping from the corner of his mouth, and Dahmer's fists and one forearm were extensively bruised. Dahmer stated he had no memory of having killed Tomey and later informed investigators that he could not believe this had happened. To dispose of Toomey's body, he purchased a large suitcase to which he transported the body to his grandmother's residence. There, 1 week later, he severed the head, arms, and legs from the torso, then flooded the bones from the body before cutting the flesh into pieces small enough to handle. He then placed the flesh inside plastic garbage bags. He wrapped the bones inside a sheet and pounded them into splinters with a sledgehammer. The entire dismemberment process took Dahmer approximately 2 hours to complete, and he disposed of all of Toomey's remains, excluding the severed head, in the trash. For a total of 2 weeks following Toomey's murder, Dahmer retained the victim's head wrapped in a blanket. After 2 weeks, Dahmer boiled the head in a mixture of Soilex, an alkali-based industrial detergent, and bleach in an effort to retain the skull, which he then used as stimulus for masturbation. Eventually, the skull was rendered too brittle by the bleaching process, so Dahmer pulverized and disposed of it. Intermediate incidents following the murder of Tomi, Dahmer began to actively seek victims, most of whom he encountered in or close to gay bars, and whom he typically lured to his grandmother's home. There, he drugged them before or shortly after engaging in sexual activity with them. Once he had rendered the victim unconscious by sleeping pills, he killed them by strangulation. 2 months after the murder of Stephen Toomey, Dahmer encountered a 14-year-old Native American male prostitute named James Dockstorter. Dahmer lured the youth to his home with an offer of $50 to pose for nude pictures. At Dahmer's West Allis residence, the pair engaged in sexual activity before Dahmer drugged him, strangled him on the floor of his cellar. Dahmer left the body in the cellar for 1 week before dismembering it in much the same manner as he had with Tomi. He placed all of Dockstorter's remains, excluding the skull, in the trash. He boiled the skull and initially retained it before pulverizing it. On March 24, 1988, Dahmer met a 22-year-old bisexual man named Richard Guerrero outside of a gay bar called the Phoenix. Dahmer lured Guerrero to his grandmother's residence, although the incentive on this occasion was $50 to simply spend the remainder of the night with him. He then drugged Guerrero with sleeping pills and strangled him with a leather strap, with Dahmer then performing oral sex upon the corpse. Guerrero's body was dismembered within 24 hours of his murder, with the remains again disposed of in the trash and the skull again retained before being pulverized several months later. On April 23rd, Dahmer lured another young man to his house. However, after giving the victim a drugged coffee, both he and the victim heard Dahmer's grandmother call, "Is that you, Jeff?" Although Dahmer replied in a manner that led his grandmother to believe he was alone, his grandmother did observe that Dahmer was not alone. Because of this, Dahmer opted not to kill this particular victim, instead waiting until he had become unconscious before taking him to the County General Hospital. In September of 1988, Dahmer's grandmother asked him to move out of her house because of his habit of bringing young men to her house late at night and the foul smells emanating from both the basement and the garage. Dahmer found a one-bedroom apartment on North 25th Street and moved into his new residence on September 25th. The following day, Dahmer was arrested for drugging and sexually fondling a 13-year-old boy whom he had lured to his home on the pretext of posing nude for photographs. In January of 1989, Dahmer was convicted of second-degree sexual assault and the enticing of a child for immoral purposes. Sentencing for the assault was suspended until May of 1989. On March 20th, Dahmer commenced a 10-day Easter absence from work, during which he moved back into his grandmother's home. 2 months after his conviction, and 2 months prior to his sentencing for the sexual assault, Dahmer murdered his fifth victim. He was a mixed-race 24-year-old aspiring model named Anthony Sears, whom Dahmer met at a gay bar on March 25, 1989. According to Dahmer, on this particular occasion, he was not looking to commit a crime. However, shortly before closing time that evening, Sears just started talking to me. Dahmer lured Sears to his grandmother's home, where the pair engaged in oral sex before Dahmer drugged and strangled Sears. The following morning, Dahmer placed the corpse into his grandmother's bathtub, where he decapitated the body before attempting to flay the corpse. He then stripped the flesh from the body and pulverized the bones, which were again disposed of in the trash. According to Dahmer, he found Sears exceptionally attractive, and Sears was the first victim for whom he permanently retained any body parts. He preserved Sears' head and genitalia in acetone and stored them in his work locker. When he moved to a new address the following year, he took the remains there. On May 23, 1989, Dahmer was sentenced to 5 years probation and 1 year in the House of Correction, with work release permitted in order that he be able to keep his job. He was also required to register as a sex offender. 2 months before his scheduled release from the work camp, Dahmer was paroled from the regimen. His 5 years probation, imposed in 1989, began at this point. On release, Dahmer temporarily moved back to his grandmother's home in West Allis before, in May of 1990, moving into the Oxford Apartments located on North 25th Street in Milwaukee. Although located in a high crime area, the apartment was close to his workplace, was furnished, and at $300 per month, inclusive of all bills excluding electricity, was economical. And that's where the chocolate factory came into the story. That's the part I didn't remember. Where I was talking earlier.
A great deal on an apartment.
Yeah. No kidding. What a super deal. So parts were in his locker. That's where the connection came into the whole story.
And it would make a lot of sense with him being a mixer and specifically working third shift that very easily there could be a tie-in of putting some special ingredients in the chocolate.
And I believe that was never anything that was proven or really had any reason to be alleged, but that was where I remember all the rumors began, was because that was part of the story that had come up. So,
do you believe that there is a situation where if there was more observant law enforcement, lives could have been saved and he could have been tried?
I think if there
earlier.
Were... And it's not, I think, necessarily the observance of the law enforcement. It's the laws in existence that are there to examine and get a full picture of individuals' mental health. All of the laws in our country, for the most part, are very much on the patient side and not so much on the caregiver side. So it's very difficult for individuals to intervene in the lives of someone who is clearly extremely mentally ill to prevent things from happening. It almost takes the disaster to happen and the tragedy to take place before those sort of things can be enforced and an individual can be retained or held or examined to a level in which they need to be. And I think that's something that needs to change because there's a lot of folks out there, not necessarily to the level of Dahmer, but clearly dangerous to themselves and to others, that, you know, with the correct treatment, if it were available, number one, and number two, if there were a bit more rights on the side of those who are truly there to care and try and help that individual, I think more people could be getting help for their issues. I don't think it's a matter of people not enforcing it. It's a matter of there's no legal way to enforce it. And that's where the problem there lies. So that's...
And when you have something that you're almost becoming addicted to, it sounds as though he is getting... I don't know if it's a confidence issue. I don't know if it's getting even more addicted to the feelings that he would get doing this.
Yeah.
And strangling his victims.
Obviously a very twisted story, but you know what? It does not end there. It gets deeper and it gets darker. And that will be coming up in our part two of the Jeffrey Dahmer story on the Dark Side of Wikipedia. For now, press subscribe, whatever platform you listen to us on. Be sure to follow us on social media, Dark Side of Wikipedia. That's where you can find us there. Dark Side of Wiki, our website. Until next time, for Sean, I'm Tony. Thanks for listening to The Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. TNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the Claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games that's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better. With new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect, the fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No.